Welcome to Great Ideas, broadcast on WKXL and available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matt Robeson. The whole idea of this podcast, Great Ideas, is trying to find experts, people with new perspectives, innovative ideas for fixing problems in America. There's perhaps no more fundamental problem in America than the growing divide. A house divided cannot stand, says the Bible, and famously said Abraham Lincoln. Ours is increasingly a house not just divided, but on the verge of being violently divided. Trying to fix that problem is, I think, the greatest challenge that we face, and the challenge that I would love to get a handle on as part of this show, as part of this podcast. Well, I have an author on today who has a different view, a historically based view on how we created this divide in the first place. And more importantly, why a better understanding historically of how we got here can inform how we begin to patch the divide and get out of this morass that we've landed ourselves in. So I am very pleased to welcome Seth David Radwell to the show. He's the author of American Schism. There's a lot more bio information about him, but I'm going to get to that later. I'm going to tease that for all of our radio and podcast listeners. Let's get right to the substance of this. Seth, welcome to the show.
Matt, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled.
It's a pleasure to have you. I won't lie, you and I share a little bit of a background, right? We have the same degree from the same institution.
Yes.
And after that, our paths went very far afield from one another. We diverged, as it were. We're going to come back to that, but that's sort of right on theme for where you launch your book. You start by tracing, even back to Europe, the development of two different Enlightenment camps.
Yes.
There were, in your words, followers of a moderate version of the Enlightenment and followers of a radical view of the Enlightenment. So maybe you can just tell us, how did those differences arise? What were those differences? And who are the people we're talking about here who might be familiar to the ears of our listeners?
Wonderful. So first of all, we have to remember that the Enlightenment was an era that characterized so many different themes. It was really a lot about reason and empirical understanding. In a way, it was a departure from centuries where the focus of society was based on how you were born and religion, et cetera. So there's a lot to be said about the Enlightenment, but for our purposes here and why it becomes a major theme of American Schism is because it was during the Enlightenment that the major, if you will, social contract, the idea of why to form a government of the people first came into being. It was the social contract thinkers that debated political philosophy for the first time. And during the latter part of the Enlightenment, those thinkers had a huge, what I call schism, break along this political philosophy, both in Europe and here. And that, of course, was the backdrop for the formation of America. That was how we came about. It's also, by the by, the backdrop for the whole idea of a modern society in many ways, which I can, it's a whole other story. But to answer your question specifically, so in Europe, there were schools of social contract thinkers from many countries, the John Locke of Thomas Hobbes, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, there are many. Montesquieu was a very important thinker. And they ended up, these differences in philosophy, in political philosophy, ended up creating this divide in America. So let me explain what that is for your listeners. The people like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, and these founders of America, if you will, were very much moderate, meaning that John Adams was an aristocrat. He was a leader of the colonies, and he very much was a governing expert. He was quite educated, astute person who had done tons of research. And so the moderate school, basically, at this time, recognized that the social contract needed to be led by people who were educated and capable of governing. And in some ways, what we call today an aristocratic republic, it was that their model. And of course, Alexander Hamilton was a great example of this. The radical differences, the people like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine, all those three particularly were what I call in the book radical enlighteners. They were very much influenced by the French radical enlightenment. And the big difference is that it was the radicals who believed in a concept of decentralized government, where the only legitimate form of governance was a representative democracy of the people. That was what the radicals believed. On the other hand, the moderates eschewed democracy. They were very fearful of democracy, which I'll come back to. The other key second difference, again, I'm simplifying for your listeners, is that the radicals had documented, especially in Europe, how for centuries the Catholic Church and the monarchy had colluded to oppress the people. And it was the radicals who came up with the idea of a separation of church and state, that the civic realm need be separate from the religious realm. And so those two concepts, that the idea of a representative democracy as the sole legitimate form of government, and the idea of keeping religion outside of the governance apparatus, those contributions were from the radicals. And the point of the first part of the book is that the split between the radicals and the moderates was a huge problem. It led, of course, to the Federalists and Jefferson's Democratic Republic. So there's a lot of history here. But more importantly, it created the Great Compromise, which became the Constitution. And that's, to your earlier point, my belief is that by understanding this history, not only at the founding, but throughout our 200 and plus years of existence, that the history of America can act as a salve for our wounds today, only if we apply it, which we so often don't.
So what you trace here is sort of this foundational layer, and then the immediately ensuing history of this compromise. And many historians have kind of plowed this territory. Miracle of Philadelphia was perhaps a classic of the genre of kind of the nitty-gritty of what went on in the constitutional compromises and the thinking of the various participants there. So I wanted to ask about this idea of compromise, because this is very much a shotgun wedding. This is not like a happy romantic fairy tale version. This is people with very different interests, and as you point out, very different fundamental ways of thinking about how government should function, coming together and saying, all right, we defeated England, now what? How did you see those compromises between these two schools, these two Enlightenment schools, manifesting themselves in our early government and in our Constitution?
One of the first aspects, in the first part of the book, is this tracing of the 11 years between 1776 and 1787, where there was a huge pendulum swing from the radical school to the moderate school. So I want to talk about that, because the point of the book going through subsequent periods of history is that there are these shifts all the time, and how we manage those shifts ends up becoming, if you will, a secret sauce of how we resolve issues, as opposed to going to war when we don't resolve that well. So 1776, was an era of incredible in radical idealistic thinking, not only breaking away from England, but famously in the Declaration, one of the most radical aspects of Jefferson's words was that, in the Locke formation, which was moderate, the inalienable rights that needed to be protected in society was life, liberty, and property. Now, think about that for a second. Property, who had property back in the 18th century? Mostly wealthy landowners. So Jefferson substitutes with property the notion of, pursuit of happiness as the third inalienable right. And think about that. All humans have the right to pursue happiness. So in a whole sense, the whole thinking of the Declaration as a credo was a much more egalitarian notion. And we could talk a lot more about that. But the point being is that egalitarian equality, all men created equal, that notion that was established in 1776 as a raison d'etre for the country. By 1787, we had such huge problems that were pragmatic, like how do we pay for the war? How do we get 13 colonies who were very different to work together to have a commerce, have a foreign, so they were all, how do we have a foreign policy, which we desperately need because we're a new nation and our only ally is France. So all of these pragmatic problems were extremely urgent on the ground. And it turns out that it was the moderates, the governors of the colonies, who had the solutions to those problems. So right. By the time we get to 1787, you have a much more moderate version. I mean, of course, the blueprint of the Constitution has the House of Representatives, which is an egalitarian representative democratic ideal and institution. But it also has the Senate, which is much more of an aristocratic. In fact, at that point, the Senate wasn't even elected at all. They were appointed by the state legislators. The idea of the president and executive power so powerful was very much a moderate idea. So my point is that there's a reason why this happened, and it's quite instructive to understand exactly how these compromises happen. And it's informative for the issues we have before us, which let me come back to. One, by the way, one of the reasons why the Federalist Papers is such an amazing political doctrine is because in essence, the Federalist Papers is an outline of the compromises between the radical and the moderate school of thought. I mean, for your listeners who are interested in history, it's fascinating because it was Madison was the kind of broker here. Jefferson is away during the Constitutional Convention in Paris being the ambassador. Benjamin Franklin, the other key radical, has gout and is very ill and old. And Thomas Paine, the other radical, is not in the room. So, the moderates really drive the solutions. Such the best example, of course, is Hamilton. And Jefferson is being insured by Madison. Like, don't worry, we have elements of our philosophy in this thing called the Constitution. And the Federalist Papers really argues about how both this representative democratic ideal is present in the blueprint, but also this notion of institutions and continuity and aristocratic, it wasn't called that, but elite government is also a key element. And anyway, so that's kind of a fascinating set of compromises, which is so important for understanding how we get out of the morass we're in today.
I've seen in other interviews you've done about this book, which has been very well received and widely praised by both academics, political scientists, and historians. So it's kind of a work of popular history, but it's also a practical political science book. And I commend you for that because that's a very hard overlap to achieve. But I've seen you in talking about this book with other interviewers, address the idea of what we got out of this grand compromise. And it does seem like America has benefited greatly. You've made the point that America has driven a lot of progress in the world. Most notably, the proportion of humanity that lives in abject poverty. It's the American system of government and our entrepreneurialism, the dynamic nature of our society, the influx of immigrants who've brought a ton of energy and new ideas, our accepting of that kind of a dynamic society. It's our entire system of government, really, that's powered this advance. Now, I'm not trying to say that America deserves credit for every good thing that's happened in the world, but credit where credit is due, we deserve a big portion of that. I think it's easy in a way to make the case, because we're all patriotic here, that we have benefited from the compromise here. We needed radicals to have a revolution. Radicals are the people who have a revolution.
Right.
Radicals are the people who say, hey, middle finger to you, king, we're going to have a very egalitarian form of democracy.
Right.
But you need moderates. You need responsible governing folks. I dare say an aspect of aristocracy
Yes.
To form a government, to form a rational government. I've always revered James Madison for his ability to kind of perform that alchemy and blend them together.
Correct.
I want to ask you the inverse question. I just made my version of the case. I'm sure you could make a more eloquent one, but I'm going to skip that. I'm going to skip the good stuff.
Right.
Did this compromise work? Because that's going to get us to the pivot to the latter half of the show, which is why understanding this history, why understanding these two threads that run through our country is so important for trying to deal with the problems we have now.
Right.
Did this compromise ultimately work between radicals and moderates and between, you know, total egalitarian separation of church, radical enlightenment and moderate enlightenment? After all, we fought a very nasty civil war, and righteously so, since we were talking about enslaved people fundamentally. And the underlying issues of that civil war were not solved by the civil war in many ways.
Correct.
And we continue to feel those issues to this day. So at a fundamental level, did the compromise work? Or is that sort of the point of your book?
The point is that it worked very imperfectly, and that all compromises do. You know, one of the great parallels here, because it's the whole point, is that how compromise and negotiation is problematic, but it's also the only realistic way forward, is immigration today. You know, in 9 years ago, the Gang of Eight had a very comprehensive bill on immigration reform that was on the table and would have, for a lot of reasons, it might have become the law of the land. This proposal, if you're familiar with it, was extremely detailed in many aspects of what today are considered immigration conundrums. And neither side, by the way, as characteristic often of compromises, neither side, meaning the Republicans, hated this solution because it had a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers. So many conservatives were not happy. Many on the left were unhappy because of this proposal. I'm referring to the Gang of Eight immigration reform bill from about 9 years ago. The left were unhappy because it had things like quotas. They weren't called quotas, but there were limits on immigration. But the point is, it had a detailed set of solutions. See, now we've been arguing about building walls and open borders for 9 years since, in the age of Trump and beyond, and we're much further away from a solution. So I think it's a good analogy to your question. We could have created an imperfect bill that had a lot of compromises. And I would argue we would have been much better off than we are 9 years later shouting each other about open borders and building walls. So that's the kind of, that's a good encapsulation of why, to answer your question directly, yes, of course the compromise worked to some degree because it perpetuated the American experiment, but it also had huge flaws, which resulted in a huge bloody war that killed, you know, millions, not only, you know, less than 80 years later. So that's kind of the point. The compromise got us to a certain point, but only to a certain point. As Franklin famously said, it's a republic if you can keep it, meaning it needs constant rejuvenation. You know, one thing I think it's important for modern readers to understand is that the founders envisioned that this blueprint, the Constitution, would be changed every generation. I don't think they anticipated how modifying it would become so intractable as it has, in my view. I think they intended for it to be always changing. And that was kind of Franklin's message in that quote. Now, of course, what happened, and this again is historically so important, during the Second Great Awakening, which happened near the end of the turn of the century, the whole idea of religion was infused with the creation of America so that the Constitution became almost set in stone. There's a famous painting, which your listeners may have seen. It was done around the turn of the century, and it portrays in this painting God handing down the Constitution to George Washington, as if it were God handing the tablets of stone to Moses. Now think about that for a second. In one hand, it's so that revisionist Second Great Awakening version of our founding is fascinating in many aspects. Well, the first is that the whole government is not supposed to be top down. It's supposed to be bottom up of the people. So in this vision that was created in the turn of the century, we completely inverted the impetus for government in the first place. But the second, of course, more logical reason why it's so ironic is that the Constitution was not supposed to be set in stone. It was supposed to change. So anyway, my point being is that if you really understand that the nature of the compromise and the set of compromises initially, as discussed, by the way, in the Federalist Papers, you understand that it's about getting from point A to B, recognizing that you're going to have to move further in the future.
What you were just laying out, Seth, was this idea that in a very real way, the design of the Constitution, which great point, the Constitution was intended to be continually adapted and updated. This idea that we're living through right now that, you know, where people placed commas in sentences to interpret meanings of words that have evolved over the last 250 years ago, those guys who were relying on even older rulings from judges in the 16th century in England, the idea that that is what has to govern our lives today is interesting. It's interesting to say the least. But your point is that fundamentally, while there were still problems, there were still divides to be bridged, we created a country that allowed slaves, for goodness sakes. So that was, I mean, it's underselling it to say that that's a problem that had to be solved.
Right.
There were clever compromises here. We had a House of Representatives, and our founders saw, look, when you have a revolt in a country, half the time it's about taxes. That's the history of what led to the revolution here. So we're going to put the taxing authority with the House of Representatives, because we're going to let people blow off steam democratically by electing those folks every 2 years. You're angry. Right. You don't like your taxes. Throw them out of office. Right. But then we're going to have this aristocratic, more moderate function in the Senate. We have to figure out how to have treaties and diplomacy. We're going to put that power at our House of Lords, basically the upper chamber. So we reach these compromises, and despite our many problems, despite the Civil War, despite the Jim Crow era, the 100 years that followed and beyond, you know, after the Civil War, managed to keep it together. But your argument that I think is more provocative, more intriguing, is that understanding those compromises, understanding that history, is critical for bridging the divide we see today.
Right.
Why?
So it's critical because, and by the way, to your point, the book traces many of these pendulum-like swings. For example, you know, the first part of Reconstruction to its eventual collapse and why that happened. Because we have in public problem solving, in the public sphere, the way problems get resolved is through, first of all, there's always great emotion and passion in public policy. That's a given. But when we've been successful, the secret sauce that we've used in make sure that to balance that passion, there is a focus on reason, facts, truth, and, you know, data. The data matter, as I often used to say in my marketing role to my teams, that, you know, in God we trust, everyone else has to bring the data. So when there's a focus on data and consequence, we tend to have these compromises. And my argument in the book is that we're increasingly abandoning that. That part of the problem with media today and the public policy debate is that it is increasingly getting removed from any notion of the pursuit of truth. And that's a very dangerous place for us to be in. So to answer your question, what matters here is understanding what the components are. What are the ingredients of a secret sauce that have allowed us at times to flourish? I mean, despite all our problems, our history of slavery, our tremendous lack of equality in so many aspects of our society, I think if you look over the past, you know, 150 years, America has become a beacon of hope for two reasons. It's not for our strong military, really. It's number one is that despite all of its flaws, it's the greatest experiment in self-governance in the history of the world. And number two, even with all its problems, it's a model for a meritocratic society that's devoid of of rights being based on how you're born by the what we call the birth lottery, more than any other experiment, which is why it's become like the, you know, the beacon of hope for entrepreneurs and for creativity. So those two, if you will, aspects, which are part of the bright side of what's made America such a great place, again, despite all the problems that we could argue about, those are in fact fundamentally driven by a continual line of progression, which has a lot of interruptions, a lot of, you know, backsteps, a lot of pendulum swings back. But at the end of the day, you know, when the Constitution was written, people who had a voice were white men with property, basically. And here we are, 200 years later, and the franchise to vote, which is maybe the most fundamental thing, it has been greatly expanded, even albeit that in the last 10 years, we see real movement through different tactics to maybe limit that right to vote. But nonetheless, it's the line from King that over the long course of history, there's a bend towards more justice. And I think that is very much true. And it's about, I hate to use this expression, but it's like not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And part of what happens in today's debate on both sides, I think, and this brings us really to how to use this history to move us forward, is there's a lack of interest in really understanding how history can be applied.
So let me read that back to you. It sounds to me like what you're arguing is we had a very fundamental divide from the beginning, and we decided that's okay. We're going to do this marriage anyway, shotgun right. or no. And we managed flaws, deep, fundamental, horribly immoral flaws in all. We managed to keep it together. And as I've argued, and as you've argued in the book, the benefits are manifest. Yes. The benefits are obvious. And so today, if we can understand, per your example of the potential immigration compromise that we just missed out on, if we can return to an idea of we all come out of an Enlightenment philosophy that is dedicated toward truth and reason. And if our forebears could work out the compromises that they did, we can as well. And we can preserve the schism. The schism is okay. It's all right that continues to exist. We just need to find ways to work through it and around it. And then that's doable, provided that we continue to rest on truth and reason. And then you argue, but we have started to lose our ability to do that in the current environment.
Yes.
Why? Why have we lost the ability to do that?
A lot has been written about this, but you know, as human beings, our historical genetic component, there's a lot of aspects that govern pleasure and pain related to being part of an in-group and attacking an out-group. And, you know, we all know the feeling of being at a football game and rooting and et cetera. So all of those primitive human emotions, which are from kind of an amygdala brain, a more primitive side of us, need expression in society. And to oversimplify, what we've screwed up is that we're treating public policy as if it's a football game. That constant need to be part of an in-group, to demonize an out-group, that's such a natural part of our primitive drive, we're using that overlay in the space of solving problems, whether it's about vaccines or whether it's about masks, and almost every public policy problem. And this brings me, you know, full circle to why the whole structure of our debate is being poisoned today. And there's a lot of reasons for this, which we can get into. I mean, the media model itself, which incentivizes outrage and entertainment, is a key part of the problem in my view as well. But part of the problem is that it's, and the reason why, as a private sector focused person, I spent 3 years working on American Schism, is because my feeling over the last couple of years increasingly is that private sector leaders, who are, by the way, focused on solving problems. That's what we do in the private sector. We try to use data to solve problems. They're increasingly putting their head in the sand because fear of bringing on the outrage of some group on the left or right make private sector leaders just want to step back and stay out of the debate. And that to me is a recipe for disaster, because we need to use a kind of a private sector mindset more and not less in resolving public policy problems. You know, almost any solution in a business problem is far from perfect. There are a lot of issues, but if you fail to act and try to use data and reason to solve the problem, you have no chance. And I feel like in some ways that's how we're treating our public policy problems today. So in a way, the call to action is to say, we've got to reinsert, even though it's fun to demonize people on the left or the right, depending on where you're coming from, and say, okay, all these, you know, Trumpies are crazy, or all these leftists, you know, whatever your perspective is, that's very destructive. And it's really about understanding different perspectives. Because at the end of the day, if to your point, if we're going to agree to have these differences but move forward, we have to have some set of, there's a hierarchy of values that we have to agree on. And that comes from understanding other people. Mm.
I want to throw kind of an interpretation at you that came out of this discussion, you know, kind of a better understanding as we've gone through it of the history you've laid out and your basic thesis. It strikes me that one of your messages here is that the schism isn't all bad, that it is, in fact, both strains have value.
Absolutely.
In our history. They've given us something, and the compromise, this is why I wanted to ask you if the compromise worked, that the compromise, what it allowed us to do is not shut off one of these two schools of thought, one of these two impulses that, yes, that kind of run through our country. We need the radical impulse, as we did in the revolution, as much as we need the moderate impulse, as we did in the founding of the country.
Correct.
One of the ways it seems to me that we've gotten off track now is, and perhaps you could, someone who's done the work on this more than I have, could maybe trace some of our historic problems, you know, more generally to this. It's almost like a cancer. It's almost like an overgrowth of one side versus the other that throws us out of balance. If the problem we're facing now is that our media and social media environment has degraded truth, it's what the election law scholar and previous guest Rick Hassan calls cheap speech.
Yes.
If cheap speech, if the degrading of the value of speech and the value of data and information and truth and fact is being driven by social media, in a way, it feels like a kissing cousin of the problem that the founders were worried about when they worried about an overgrowth of democracy, an yes, overgrowth of kind of populism. And yeah, that's what we're seeing in social media, rather than having authoritative sources of information. And look, this can go too far. You can end up with authoritarianism. You can end up with aristocracy. There are plenty of people on the left who will tell you, look, the problem in America is that the average CEO salary is 400 times the average worker salary. That's equally a problem as too many voices being able to say stuff.
Yes.
They might have a point. But when you talk about trying to refine our way to how do we have a fact-based, data-based discussion, a discussion based around truth and about a give and take between these two schools of thought, what do you make of the idea that if it's the ways we communicate, if it's social media, if it's the loss of traditional media, that that's sort of the problem we have to solve before we can sit down at the table? We have to decide, what kind of table are we going to sit at? You know, where are we going to have the conversation? What are the ground rules?
Who's going to be at the table? Who gets a seat?
Who's going to be at the table?
Right. Absolutely. So you know, where American Schism goes, the third part lays out a plan for how to tackle this problem, if I can be so bold. And it's around two types of changes. One are structural reforms that I'm convinced need to happen. And one of those is in media incentives. And I'm not arguing for a public control of media, but I am arguing for different incentives in the business system for media. So I won't go into the structural changes, but the other set of changes that are put forth in the book are about mindset changes. and about how we talk to each other and why and how we understand each other. And that's where, you know, the work with organizations like Braver Angels and No Labels that I've done, that those organizations are very much driving towards a different conversation. But to come back to your point, if the head fake in the American Schism thesis, that is that it's not a war between the moderates and radicals that matter. I mean, you nailed it. It's that the real problem is whether we're going to embrace those two different philosophies as important, both of them, and move forward, or are we going to take more of a counter-enlightenment approach and abandon truth altogether, which to me is the real danger. And again, history has analogs that, you know, the American Revolution was part of, it was part of a global movement. And its sister revolution, the French Revolution, ended in disaster. And a lot of why it did, and by the way, the book also parallels these two revolutions. You know, the French Revolution turned entirely towards a counter-revolution, a complete abandonment of reason. And it was extremely bloody. So in many ways, relative to the French Revolution, our revolution was quite successful by having a constitution and moving us forward. And that in and of itself is the lesson that if we completely abandon the pursuit of this Enlightenment framework that has provided more prosperity in the last 200 years than in the prior 2000, if you look at the data, meaning, you know, to your point, in 1800, life expectancy was 31 across the globe. Now it's over 70 everywhere. I mean, the facts show that we've made huge progress, okay, in poverty and even though there's still a lot of suffering. If we abandon that framework of a modern society, which I'm convinced more and more we are doing, there's a move towards autocracy all over the globe, then we risk abandoning what Jonathan Rauch calls the constitution of knowledge, the way we build knowledge and solve problems decentralized in a collective way as a society based on institutions and expertise, et cetera. So that the danger is not moderate versus radical. The danger is if we throw the entire Enlightenment experiment out completely, which in the past 50 years, even more so than recent decades, the postmodern movement is very much an anti-Enlightenment movement for many reasons. And I think that's quite dangerous.
I can understand from a humanist perspective how anyone could look at the history you've looked at, could look at the data you've looked at and say, we've got to save America, for goodness sakes, because of all the good it's done. I mean, the journalist Stephen Johnson, who's written some of the best science journalism, The Ghost Map, in the world, and has recently written Second Life, which shows that over the last 100 years, humanity has gained an entire second life. Yeah. Our life expectancy has doubled. Why? It's because of the kinds of things that our system of government enables, right? Public health measures, the way we're able to work together collectively on the basis of science, rationality, data, and reason, right, to make life better for people. So this is worth keeping.
It's worth saving.
Right. But I gotta ask, that's a great impulse that you have. And I believe that, you know, you're a good person who kind of wants to save America because you're a humanist. But why do you, Seth David Radwell, want to do this? Why did you take 3 years to write this book? This is where we gave a classic radio tease at the top of the show. And I'm like, your background's kind of interesting. We got the same Master of Public Policy degree. Young people out there, if you're considering getting a graduate degree, don't get an MPP. Don't get it. It's you're a jack of all trades, master of none. I don't think it's a valuable degree. But you and I both got this degree, and then you did something useful with it. You became a captain of industry. You had any number of executive positions. You were the president of eScholastic, which is the digital arm of the global children's publishing company. You had executive positions with beauty companies. The point is, you could have continued being what sounds to most ears like a plutocrat. You decided not to do that. And now you're a lowly book author appearing on the radio trying to save America. What happened to you, Seth? Why did you go down this path to ruin? Why do you care?
Well, so obviously, as you've alluded to, this is not this. I didn't take this path from the perspective of profit, or you don't write a book like American Schism to make money.
I can tell you as a writer, I mostly write articles. You do not become a writer to make money unless you're Stephen Johnson, Michael Lewis, et cetera.
Right. Okay. Right. So we agree. So the point was, is that I was increasingly distressed that, the private sector, to your point, I've been a CEO of, most recently I was the CEO of Proactive, an acne brand. I was distressed that the private sector leadership has abandoned discussions of these important issues to such a degree. I was already convinced prior to Trump that basically the political industry is broken, in my view. And I laid this out in the book. The public sector leadership is now driven not by solving problems, but by perpetuating itself in office. That is, you know, if you can't see that, I mean, almost all federal elected officials spend more time and money trying to get reelected than solving problems. So I've been convinced for quite a while that the public sector leadership is largely broken. But what pushed me to do this, to your question, is it's a call to action to private sector leaders that if we want to hand a democracy to our kids, if we want to, we can't be silent about this stuff. We have to get involved. And, you know, what my research shows, Matt, is that 70% of America is part of what I call the exhausted majority or the frustrated majority, meaning that most people don't believe that they don't feel like the left or the right extremes really represent what they think, but they also don't feel empowered to make a difference. They feel frustrated. And right. So the call to action is for every one of those frustrated majority citizens, whether they're private sector leaders or public sector leaders, or is to take steps to get involved. It really is a call to action. And that's my motivation for doing this.
Well, that makes all kinds of sense to me. And, you know, we're recording this on a Wednesday. I just this morning news emerged, and I'm going to step out of my nonpartisan lane here for just a moment, that there's a massive effort underway by people who denied the results of the last election, people who bought into the so-called big lie, to essentially pack the poll workers across America to take over, not poll watching, but to actually become the people who run the polls. These are the cogs and gears of our democracy, the people who are supposed to be nonpartisan, who are making elections run. And there is a concerted, calculated effort for people who deny the results of the last election to take that over. I just got finished, as we were getting on recording this, putting out an impassioned plea over Twitter for people to go to organizations that are nonpartisan to get training. And go look this up as you listen to this. You can find me at Matt L. Robeson on Twitter. I'm always looking for follows, but go find me on Twitter. I have a whole thread where I lay out the organizations that you can go to.
Yes.
Because there's nothing more important. And this is the major point I've taken away from, you know, the book and the discussion, is this is worth saving. And the same things that divide us are also sort of what invigorates us, invigorates the American experiment. We very much depend on the radical notions. We very much depend on the moderate notions that are part of our cultural and government DNA. The philosophers behind the show South Park nailed this 20 years ago when they did a show that concluded with the idea that we're a little bit country and we're a little bit rock and roll, and we need both. Both are a part of the tapestry of our country. And if we lose that understanding and our ability to see that we need each other, then we truly are lost. And on that note, which was perhaps more inspirational than I intended it to be, we have to wrap up. Seth David Radwell, the book is American Schism. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it wherever you get your books. You can find great ideas wherever you get your podcasts. Seth, thanks so much for joining us.
Matt, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.